Well, good luck tonight.
Thank you. Hopefully I'll get back okay. That's all that matters. So let's find the screen share. Why can't I find the screen share? Oh, so my brain is still in driving. Okay, so when we last week we had a bit of a shorter parak. We talked about David and Mephibosheth, and the general idea then was that the Navi kind of took a break, and it seemed like even chronologically we took a break. We were going back in time towards the beginning of David's reign, before all of those victories against Ammon and Moab and Edom and Aram, and the Navi wanted to emphasize David's chesed. That after so many different failed attempts, it seems like we finally have reconciled the family of David and the family of Shaul. We've found a fugitive member of the house of Shaul. David has given him all of Shaul's lands. He's made him very rich. He's made him very important. One of the Mefarshim suggested he's made him a real officer in the court, even serving like the Mishneh LeMelech, which had been the original vision of David and Yehonasan. So the third generation is the charm, and we've successfully ended that conflict and brought those two families together. It's all because of Chesed David's real desire for Chesed. We suggested then that the reason why that parak was there was we wanted to have it back to back with parak Yud, which is once again a parak about David's Chesed. But one of the questions we have to figure out is, you know, last week David's Chesed was a smashing success. It led to the reconciliation between David and Mephibosheth. The question this week is going to be whether David does the right thing or not, because really now looming in the background is going to be the fact that next week we're going to start the parak of David and Bathsheba. So what is the relationship going to be between this parak and that parak? That's going to be one major thing for us to work on in this parak. And the other thing for us to focus on is that this parak is really the finest hour for Yoav, David's general, who's had a complicated history until now, some higher moments when he's conquering Yerushalayim and when he's ensuring that David can pursue Tzedek and Mishpat, and some lower moments when he's assassinating Avner and helping spearhead a civil war. This parak is going to be his real finest hour, and we're going to see some of the things that the Navi does with that. So the Navi begins, and it tells us, V'hiach rechin v'yamas melech b'nei Amon v'yimloch chanun b'no tachtav. So the father of Hanun dies. That was Nachash. Nachash, the king of Ammon, dies. And David says, I want to do chesed. So back to back. Chesed. David, Esa chesed of Hanun ben Nachash. Kasher asa aviv imadi chesed. His father did chesed with me. We'll talk about that in a second. Vayishlach David l'nacham obiyad avadav el aviv. So he sends a nicham avelim delegation. Vayvo abdei David eretz b'nei Ammon. And they... So David's servants reach the land of Ammon, going to do a Nichum Avelim delegation to the new king, because David wants to reciprocate for the chesed that had been done to him. But as well-intentioned as that may be, it ends in disaster, because Pasuk Gimel tells us that the officers there tell Hanun, come on, you think this, David you think that David is doing this to honor you? One of the many times in David's life when he's misunderstood and something that he's doing, which is impressive. So people think that there are more sinister, ulterior motives. No, David is sending his people to spy. What does Hanun do? He does something very surprising. He takes the servants, he takes David's delegation, he shaves off half their beards, he splits their robes down the middle, you know, along a vertical slit, ad shiso sehem, until literally the place where they're split, right? So he cuts their robes all the way up the leg so that clothing is no longer rendered functional. Everyone can see their nakedness. Vayishalchem, he sends them away. Okay. Very strange what Hanun is doing. Normally, the punishment for spies is to have them executed. When Yehoshua sends two spies to Yericho, and so the people of Yericho look up and down the city to find the two spies because they want to have them killed. So it's kind of funny what Hanun does. We'll talk about Abarbanel in 1 second. And then he says that David was told what happened, and the people are very embarrassed. So David says, have the people wait in Yericho, Yericho is the city which is right on the border, right? The reason why it's the first city that Bnei Yisrael conquer when they enter the land of Israel is it's the first city you're going to reach when you cross over the Jordan River. So David's delegation is coming back from the other side of the Jordan River, coming back from Ammon. They should wait in Yericho. The Dot Micker points out they're not in the built-up city of Yericho. They're in the abandoned ruins of Yericho, because Yericho has been a ruin since the days of Yeshua. It's not going to be rebuilt until the time of King Achav. It's the perfect place for them to wait. We'll send them food. We'll send them supplies. Once their beards grow back, so then they can come back and rejoin society. Until then, they should stay in the ruins of Yericho. But even the fact that the Navi mentions Yericho here, where we know that's the last time that Bnei Yisrael sent spies, was when they sent spies to Yericho, we need to ask, what exactly is this Hanun, the king of Ammon, doing? So the Abarbanel is a very interesting suggestion. I want to tweak it a little bit. Abarbanel points out that, well, there's something good and there's something bad that's happening in David's delegation here, according to the Ammonim, right? It's very nice you're sending us a Nicham Avelim delegation. It's also very unfortunate that you're using Nicham Avelim as an opportunity to allegedly spy on the land. So, Barbanel, the basic suggestion is, any Batman fans in the Shear, so, well, you know, one of the villains is Two-Face. You know, half his face looks very handsome, half his face is hideous. So Barbanel basically says that's the punishment that Hanun meets out to David's delegation. There, right, you are two-faced with us. You're giving us a delegation which is half lovely and half spying. Well, we're going to cut off half their beards and we're going to cut off half of their clothing, right? So, you know, one half, they look very impressive. On the other half, they look like embarrassed fools, right? I mean, clean shaven and naked is the day that they were born. So, you know, Abarbanel does something a little bit different. I think that's the basic idea, though, is that there's a message that's being sent here to David. We see through your ruse and you're being two-faced. Okay, so it was a nice plan, didn't work out. Question we need to ask, though, is, you know, all this chesed that David was trying to do, it seems like it was impressive. And we can sense a number of parallels between the chesed of this week and the chesed we had last week. Last week, we had David trying to find the next generation after there were, to put it mildly, some complicated histories with the previous generations of the family, and David wants to finally reconcile with the house of Shaul. Here, once again, there is a very complicated history that Nachash, the king of Ammon, has with Bnei Yisrael. At the same time, seems to have a nice personal history with David. Rashi and the other Mefarshim explain, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago when we saw David conquering Moab, that after Moab, not in the Pesukim, but after Moab, you know, outside of the text, wipes out David's family, one brother survives, flees to the king of Ammon, Nachash the king of Ammon, and Nachash the king of Ammon gives that brother a place of security. Whether he's doing that out of graciousness to David, or whether he's doing that because he's an enemy of Bnei Yisrael and he wants to help David, who at the time is the enemy of Shaul, that's not so clear. But the Mefarshim all assume that that is the piece of personal chesed that Nachash did to David. At the same time, this guy Nachash was the person who launched the career of Shaul back in Shmuel Aleph, Parak Yud Aleph. He was the one, if you remember, who sent the threatening message to the city of Yavesh Gilad, the Jews on the other side of the Jordan River, saying, either submit to my rule and every single person in the city is going to cut out his right eye, or I'm going to come in and kill all of them. So Nachash, not the greatest guy. So David partially is trying to repay the chesed of the last generation, just like last week when he's trying to repay the chesed with Yehonasan. He's also trying to reconcile. This is an opportunity to get past the complicated issues of the previous generation, the unfortunate policies of the last administration. Let's get some shalom here between Bnei Yisrael and Bnei Am. And of course, it blows up in his face. The question is what David did good or not? Truth is, in the Pshat and the Pesukim, it sounds pretty impressive. David is trying as hard as he can. We see the Pesukim refer to David by name. See that three times in one pasuk. Just like last week, when David was talking to Mephibosheth, the Navi wanted to emphasize his human side. So he had been the Melech when he was talking to Tziva, the servant of Mephibosheth. But then in that face-to-face meeting between Mephibosheth and David, the Navi called him David again and again. Same thing over here, right? David as a chesed em chanun, v'yeshlach David l'nachamo, v'yehu avdi David eretz b'nei Ammon. He's David. It's a human personal connection he's trying to create. Seems very impressive. On the other hand, Radak quotes the Medrash. It's the Medrash of Bamidbar Rabbah. It's also the Tanchuma, which is critical of David. Medrash says, hey, Amon is from the nation, about which we were told, Lo Sidrosh Shaloma Metovasam. Do not seek out their peace and their goodness, right? Amon was cruel to us. Torah says, you know, Lo Yavo. No, they can never join the community, and you shall never seek their peace. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the prohibition against going to war against Amon and Moab, whether or not that was a permanent prohibition or only temporary. But this prohibition of Lo Sidrosh Shaloma Tovasam, it's black on white in the Pesukim. This lasts forever. So let's just scroll down for a second. What does Torah say? Lo Sidrosh Shaloma Tovasam Kol Yamecha Liolam. All your days forever. I mean, Torah couldn't make it as clear if it wanted to. That this prohibition against seeking out the peace of Amon is eternal. Why? Al Devar Shelo Kid Mu'eschem Alachem V'Mayim B'Derech V'Tzeischem V'Tzrayim. We talked about this. The total betrayal. Amon and Moab are supposed to be our brothers, supposed to be our relatives, the descendants of Lot. And yet they totally lost the chesed, which at least that was the one thing that Lot thought he was holding on to, where not only did they not, they didn't give us bread and water in the desert, and they even hired Bilam ben Beor from Aram Naharaim to try to curse us. And the Torah says, we're done. The relationship is totally severed with Amon and Moab. They can never again rejoin B'nai Yisrael. The family ties have been completely and irrevocably broken. So the Medrash says over here, David, what are you doing sending a peace delegation to Hanun, the king of Amon? Torah said, Lo Shadosh Shalom Tovasam Kol Yamecha Le'olam. How does the Medrash conclude what the other story over here? Al Tehit Tzadik Harbe. Right? Pasuk in Koheles, do not be excessively righteous. Mikan Shlo Yadam Avater Al A Torah person should not be, you know, my moral sense is superior to the sense of the Torah. Now, Chazal bringing in that pasuk from Kohelas, Al Tehi Tzadik Harbe. We've seen this move once before in Sefer Shmuel, very prominently. That's what Chazal had to say, of course, to Shaul after he hesitated to fully wipe out Amalek. And at the time, Chazal pointed out, what happens to the person who is tzaddik harbe, who's excessively righteous? Then you're going to have the second half of the pasuk of Koheles, al tarshia harbe, don't be excessively wicked. The same Shaul who refuses to wipe out Amalek, well, a couple of prakim later, once he's following his own moral compass, instead of the moral compass of the Ribbono Shel Olam, he's going to be wiping out the entire city of Novi Arkon. The message the Medrash seems to be getting across is the exact same thing over here. If David in Perek Yud is being an Al Tehi Tzadik Harbe personality, he's being excessively righteous. I think it's time to have peace with Amon. Well, what's the Al Tarshia Harbe? When are we going to see David following his own inclinations instead of submitting to the divine yoke? Right down the pike, right? It's one Perek later when this Tzadik Harbe attitude of David is going to be committing adultery and trying to get the husband of the person he slept with murdered. Right, so it fits this read of the psukim over here, fits the same pattern. In a place where you find excessive chesed beyond what the Torah thinks that you should do, even though at face value it seems very impressive, well, you know, the long-term picture about this is not going to end. Okay, so that seems to be how the Medrash here is understanding what David is doing. A little bit surprising, though, because the truth is, in the Pesukim themselves, it seems like David's conduct is totally above board and very impressive, and it's really all the Ammonim and who are to blame. Happens to be, if you look at Rashi carefully, Rashi does not seem to understand the Pesukim this way, because Rashi brings in the same prohibition against having peace with Amon, except he doesn't bring it in as a criticism of David. Rashi actually brings it in as the explanation of the advisors of the king of Ammon why they shouldn't trust David. See, Rashi says on the pasuk, "Hamachabe David asavicha beinacha." Rashi says, "Hanir beinacha shadavim machabe asavicha." You think that David is doing this to actually honor your father? Hemus harlo sidrosh shalom. They're warned not to seek out peace with you. Who you drosh shalom? Chai, you think that David is actually seeking your peace? No way. It says in their Bible, "Don't seek out our peace." We have to be suspicious. If that's the way Rashi is quoting the pasuk here, then it sounds like the pasuk is Rashi's understanding. This was a tragic misunderstanding. Indeed, David was trying to seek out their peace. Now, why would David want to do that? And what would be David's justification? Well, it's implicit in the Rambam, and then it's made explicit in the Hagos, Maimonios, right there on the bottom. I'll talk about those in a second. The Rambam in the sixth chapter of the Laws of Kings and Wars, so he tells us at the beginning of the Parak, number one rule about war is that everybody shall go to war. They always need to send out peace feelers. Always has to be done. You can't go to war unless you send out a peace option. It's a very controversial statement because the Rambam seems to apply that even to Amalek and the seven nations of Canaan. I think the Ravik gets very angry at the Rambam for saying that. But that's what the Rambam says. And Halachavah, the Rambam tells us there's one exception. Amalek, Canaan, you always have to send a peace delegation. One exception, Amun Amav, Ein Shalchel, Am Shalom, Olam. You never send a peace delegation to Amun Amav, because that's what the Torah says in Devar. Okay, talks a little more, but then at the end the Rambam says, Af Al Pisha Ein Shalom, Mishlamam, even though we are not allowed to send a peace delegation to Amun or Moav, Im Hishlimu Me'atzman Tchila, the Kabbalah Nosan. If they send us a peace delegation, then we are allowed to accept it. We cannot proactively offer peace to Amun and Moav, but if they reform, they do tshuva, they want to turn around, you know, tshuva is always open to those who want it. You know, Rus was able to rejoin the Jewish people, and if Amun and Moav want to send a peace delegation, we can accept it. Okay, well then we might wonder, what exactly is the status of David's delegation? On the one hand, David never received a peace delegation from the king of Ammon. On the other hand, the king of Ammon's father did chesed to David. So the Hagos HaMunios, which is one of the students of the Maharami Rutenberg, so this is like, you know, late 1200s Ashkenaz, writes, just like we have the Ramah, who writes glosses on the Shulchan Aruch. So a couple of hundred years earlier, the Hagos HaMunios, right, literally, Hagos on Maimonides. So there are glosses on the Rambam. So he quotes the Re'im, Rabbi Lazar Mitz, who's one of the Balei HaTosfot, writes the Sefer Yireim. He's a student of Rabbeinu Tam. So the Yireim writes on this mitzvah of not seeking out the peace of Amun and Moav, he says there's an exception clause. Maidvar Murim, Bidrisha Shalom. You can't seek their peace. Aval Tashlum Shalom, responding with peace. Mutter, that's totally acceptable. Kigon im asu imcha chesed. If they did kindness for you, mutter lefakta l'shalom. You can remember them for peace. What's his proof? Shneimar vayamas nach b'nei Amon v'yamachanu b'notach tav v'yamar David esech chesed imchanu. The Yireim says, and God's Hamunios quotes this lahalacha. It's clear. Read the psukim straight. And it sounds like what David is doing is wonderful. So how are we going to rectify David's conduct, which the Pshat and the Psukim seem to endorse with the lasting prohibition against seeking the peace of Amun and Moav? No problem. You can seek their, you can't seek their peace, but if you are reciprocating, that's acceptable. Okay. Now, the Malbim actually says, the Malbim is able to, kind of bring the two together. The Malbim says, I'll explain to you what Chazal were saying. After all, this idea of the Rambam and the Hagos HaMaimonides and the Re'im makes a lot of sense. Like, really? If Amun Amav, the Torah told us black and white, the reason why we can't seek out their peace is because they wouldn't do chesed with us. Well, if they change, really, it's not going to, we can't respond in return? Like, that seems kind of shocking. So the Malbim explains, yeah, but there's a very subtle issue over here, which is the chesed that was shown from Nachash, the dead king of Ammon, to David, that was not national peace, right? He was not sending a diplomatic delegation to the king of Israel saying, let's have peace between our nations. It was a personal favor to David. It was personal chesed. And David then sends a national delegation. Now, even at the time when David was on the run, David was, everyone knew he was an anointed king. So the status of that peace, you know, that chesed to David is kind of complicated. Is it personal? Is it national? And that's why you can sense that there are really two basic ways we have in the Mefarshim Chazal about how to understand David's conduct here. The Midrashim, which the Radak quotes, which are saying that what David did, it seems nice on the surface, but it's actually a classic example of somebody who's being more righteous than the Torah, which you know, ultimately means being less righteous in the Torah. And a whole bunch of mafarshim over here who are saying actually that what David did was fine because he was responding to the peace offer to the chesed of Chana. Okay, it's more to say, but let's leave that for now because really got to get to the battle, right? So David gets that peace delegation back, and as you know, if we think back to the story of David with Naval, so we know that David has a strong side to his personality, and as suffused with chesed as David may be, insulting David and going after his men is a terrible idea, which is exactly the behavior you want in a king. You don't want a king who's going to be some, you know, piece of milk toast who's going to turn the other cheek and let you walk all over. So Amon realizes that they're in trouble. David is now furious, and that's not going to go well. So what does Amon do? So Amon reaches to the north. Remember, Amon is on the other side of the Jordan River, right? Kind of basically just to the north and east of the Dead Sea. To the north of Amon and Moab, you have Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. And then to the north of them, you have all of the different small kingdoms of Aram in modern-day Syria and part of Turkey. So they hire a couple of the kingdoms of Aram, Aram Rehov, Aram Tsova, the king of Macha, Ish Tov. Last time we saw Tov in the Navi, I think, was in the Yiftach story. You know, Tov was one of the lands to the north and to the east of the land of Gad and Manasseh over there. So basically, we're now having two massive armies converging on the Jews on the other side of the Jordan River. Right? We have Amon, and it seems like Moab joined them, coming from the south. And we have all of Aram coming from the north, trying to clamp together on the Jews on the other side of the Jordan River. So David knows about this. What does David do? David, quintessential man of energy, immediately, so David immediately sends Yoav and the Tzva HaGiborim. This sounds like it is the professional army. It's not the full army of, you know, every male between age 20 and 60. There isn't enough time for a full mobilization. David seems to understand we need to strike, and we're going to strike immediately. So we're going to get as many men and the best men we possibly can, and we're going to send them and try to handle this. Now what happens? So Yoav gets there, and Yoav realizes that that he's in trouble, because he seems to have gotten there too late, right? It seems like the goal was going to be to first knock out one army and then quickly run in and knock out the other army. You know, I was in the Civil War, like Stonewall Jackson. That's like one of the things, one of the major successes he had was that even though he was an outnumbered army, because the, you know, Union armies were stronger, but you know, his chachma was, well, I'm a small army, but I'm fast, and I'm also a competent general. So if there are three huge Union armies, but they're all led by like sluggish and incompetent generals, well, you know, I can hit one, hit the other, and then I can move on. So that seems to be what Yoav wanted to do. But by the time Yoav gets there, it's too late. Both armies are in the field, the army of Aram, right, from the north, and the army of Amon from the south. So now what's Yoav going to do? He's surrounded. So one option Yoav could have is he could be, okay, I'm going to turn around and go home. And at least let's save the Jews on the Israel side of the Jordan River. But that's not what Yoav is going to do. Instead, Yoav really desists his finest hour. Navi says, Yoav realized that there are armies against him on both fronts, in front and the back. So he takes the elite units of the army. Remember, we're already dealing with the professional army, the Tzva Giborim. So he takes the elite units and he says, the elite units, we're going to fight against Aram. And he's going to lead that. Right? He takes the rest of the army and he entrusts it with his brother Avishai. Most places here included, he's actually pronounced Avshai, even though I think we always say Avishai. And they're going to fight against Amon. Right? So he's splitting his own army. Now, the Malbim really has a great analysis of the military strategy over here. The Malbim says there's tremendous chachma. What Yoav realizes is that even though Amon has a very large army, well, the Navi told us that the army of Amon laid out by Archumachal Pesach Hashar, right by the gate of their city. And Yoav realizes that Ammon is the weaker power. They're not as strong as Aram. And he senses the fact that they are arranging their forces by their city, it means that actually they do not want to have an aggressive fight. They're afraid. The Malbim says, if they would march out and unite with Aram, then that army would be too much for the Jews to deal with. But he senses that they are afraid. They're staying near their city. And he thinks that if I have the weaker army with Avishai to pin them down, just to keep the two armies from uniting, that'll be doable. They'll be able to pin down Ammon. They're not really looking to join up with Aram. And if they pin them down, then I can go by myself and I can attack Aram and then come back and help. Right? That seems to be the general strategy. In which case, and this is going to be a theme we'll elaborate in a little bit, Ammon is kind of backstabbing Aram over here. Right? You call them to ally with you, and then push comes to shove, they kind of stay home. So Yoav tells Avishai, here's the deal. So if I am being overwhelmed by Aram, so you will help me. The Malbim explains that Avishai's men are staying in the fortified camp, like right next to the enemy city. If surprisingly the people from Ammon come out and they attack you, so I'll try to help you. Right, we're going to help each other. And then very, 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 very famous pasuk. Chazak ben es chazak biyad amenu, right? We'll strengthen ourselves for our people. Uv'ad are elokenu, for the cities of our God, not just any cities, right? We're talking about Eretz Yisrael. These are the cities of Ribono Shalom. V'Hashem yaseh tov beinav, and Hashem will do what is good in his eyes, right? That is the line of Yoav. I think it's still quoted, like Ad Hayom Hazeh. Radak and Ralbag both have very important comments on this last pasuk. Radak just points out that even though we think of Yoav as like the quintessential warrior, conqueror, general, when push comes to shove, Yoav sees himself as fighting a defensive war over here, right? We're protecting our people, shlo yulacharev ulashavi, so they shouldn't be put to the sword into the captivity, and we're defending the city, shlo yikavshu asam ayvenu, right? That's our job. Our job is to play defense. Our job is to protect our people. Yoav does not see himself as some, swashbuckling conqueror. He's there to protect Bnei Yisrael. And at the end of the day, right, Hashem Yaseh Tov Beinav, we will do the best we can. The Gemara in Brachos actually says that we learn from Yoav's conduct here that someone who's a professional, so he needs chizuk. Even though you think you're an expert in something, you still need a chizuk. Gemara learns that from Yoav right over here. Hashem Yaseh Tov Beinav. Hashem do the best. Ki Lashem Atshua. Ultimately, we do the best we can. But ultimate salvation comes from Hashem. And the Ralbag says it's black on white. Very important idea. What do we learn from Yoav over here? Laman Mizeh. She'in roi lismoch al anes. We can't rely on a miracle. Avaru'ui she'ishtadeh ha'adam ba'atzal aso k'fi she'afshar. First has to try as hard as he can. V'az yashar Hashem yisparach. And then he also has to have faith and the help for Rosh Hashem. Right? So the idea that we put in our hashtadlus as much as we can, while at the same time davening and knowing that at the end of the day, ultimate victory depends on the Ribono Shel Olam. That is exactly the hashkafa which Yoav is saying right now. Right? It's Yoav's finest hour. The courage he has against the superior force, the humility he has in saying to Avishai, look, if I lose, you'll help me out. And the hashkafa. What is the hashkafa of the Jewish soldier supposed to be? We actually don't learn it from David, surprisingly. We learn it from Yoav, trying as hard as we can, the strategy and the courage and the bravery and the thought process, while at the same time, the ultimate tefillah and the ultimate hope in the redemption from the Ribono Shel Olam. Okay, so how does it, and by the way, we should just contrast what Yoav says right over here with the previous time we've seen a battle cry like this. Last time we saw something similar was when the Plishtim were fighting Bnei Yisrael, the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, and the Plishtim panicked because the Aron Kodesh was brought to the battle. And the Plishtim, who were pagans, thought that that meant that the Jewish gods had shown up. What do the Plishtim say over there? His chaskub yu lanashim, strengthen yourselves and be men, Plishtim. Pen tavdul ivrim kasher avdulachem, lest you serve the Hebrews just like until now they've had to serve you. Be men in fight. That's the plishti attitude towards war. Man up, be men, right? Dominate. We want to enslave them, otherwise they'll enslave us. That is not Yoav's hashkafa towards war, right? There's nothing about enslaving Amon and enslaving Aram. Nothing about being like Anashim. Yeah, we have to strengthen ourselves, but not because of our own military pride. We have to think of our families. We have to think of our nation. We have to think of Eretz Yisrael. And ultimately, right, of course, the part of the pasuk here, which is there, the Pleshim don't say, you know, and Dagon our God, ultimately he'll decide. Yoav says, we have to try the best we can. And ultimately, we dive and know that Hashem is the best thing at heart, right? That is the ethos of the Jewish soldier. And we get it right here from Yoav. Okay, amazing. How does the battle work out? Works out as well as you could possibly. Well, that works out pretty well. Yoav attacks, Aram flees, right? Miraculously, it seems pretty clear that there's divine help over here because Yoav is outnumbered, and yet Aram runs away. And then as soon as Amon sees that Aram ran away, so they run back into the city. So the battle is successful. There hasn't been a strategic victory, right? Aram runs away, kind of intact. Amon goes into the city, they remain intact, but Yoav and Avishai have managed to split the two forces, and they've managed to rescue a victory from the jaws of defeat. Okay, so let's just finish the rest of the parak, and then we should take a step back and talk about a couple of messages which come out from the parak as a whole. What happens next? So Navi tells us that Aram realizes that, you know, okay, for strike one, that didn't work out. So they all gather themselves together. All the different tribes of Aram are coming together. Hadad Ezer, who we said was the king of Aram Tzova, the strongest of the Aramean city-states. So he brings his army. Then he gets Shovach, who's the general of his army. So Shovach would be for Hadad Ezer, what Yoav is for David. Right after we had Yoav's amazing victory, now we see his colleague, Shovach. What happens? Navi tells us this time, David's able to fight the battle differently. He doesn't just send Yoav and Avishai and the Tzva HaGiborim. This time, David gathers all of Bnei Yisrael. He goes himself. He crosses the Jordan River. He does battle against the Plishtim. And this time, it's a strategic victory. Yanasar Mei Yisrael, Bayrog David Mar Aram, Shvamios Rechev, right, chariots and horses. Shovach, that general, is killed. And then there's a diplomatic victory. All the kings who had served Hadad Ezer realized that, we're losing. So, you know, when you're vassals to one king and that king is losing, you switch sides. So they served, they made peace with Bnei Yisrael instead. And Aram has canceled the alliance with Amon. Alliance is left in the dust. Amon has to fend for themselves, right? So all the alliances, all the different groups that had united against Bnei Yisrael, they've all broken up. Some of the vassals have sided now with Bnei Yisrael. Amon is alone. Hadad Ezer is isolated. And we've gone from really a dire situation where all of the enemies were united against us to now all the enemies have been divided. Okay, so we come out of the parak, we have David's amazing chesed for the second time, complicated how to think of it. We have Yoav and Avishai, and really Yoav's skill as a general and his bitachon as a general, which is also essential if you're a Jewish general, on full display. And then we have this phenomenal victory with David at the head. So there are two points that I just want to drill down as we come out of the parak. As we reflect, there I saw one of the modern commentators make this point. A theme we have in the parak, right, is a theme of splitting and division. Try to think about it. There's the first thing we saw. The Navi had to tell us like three different ways that Hanun divided. He cut half the beard, and he split their clothes up until the point where their legs split. And we have two different armies, and Yoav and Avishai have to split their army up into two and fight two different battles, right? And the idea of division came up again and again and again in the parak. all leading up to what? Right, this the point I saw this I did not see, but I think it's clear. All those divisions lead up to the amazing unity and brotherhood of Yoav and Avishai. Right, you have division, 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 and then Yoav and Avishai coming together, fighting as brothers in arms. Now, Yoav and Avishai as brothers in arms is really interesting because who are these two brothers? And they are biological brothers. Well, who are they fighting against? They're fighting against Aram. They're fighting against Ammon. And the perverseness of all of this is that Aram and Ammon are supposed to be brothers of Bnei Yisrael, right? We have our two brothers, Yoav and Avishai, who are fighting a war against nations that are supposed to be our brothers. Lavan said to Yaakov, Lavan Arami, he said, right? Achi Achiata, you are my brother. Lavan is not just some person from Aram. You know, we like, there's so much that happens in Parshas Vayera that we just skip over the end of the Parsha. But when Avram was told about all of the new Mazel Tovs in the family, well, Torah said that one of the kids that Nachar had was Kemuel Avi Aram. What does it mean, Kemuel Avi Aram, the father of Aram? Aram himself was a person in Parshas Noah. Well, that Mikra explains, probably other Parshas too, I just didn't have a chance to look at them last night. Avi Aram means he becomes the leader and the head settler of the lands of Aram Naharaim. Lavan is a leading political figure in Aram. Avram comes from a big family. It's a big deal that Avram leaves Haran. Terach and Avram, they're leading members in society in Aram. Right? These are two leading families. And now Aram, right, far from behaving like brothers, of course, they go to war. Lot as well, of course, Ammon and Moab, I mean, the Torah drilled it home for us in the battle of the four kings and the five kings. Other times, also that David calls, that Avram calls Lot his brother. But in the battle of the four kings and the five kings, Yishma Avram, Kinishba Achiv, right, Lot's his brother. And Avram goes to rescue. How do our brothers reciprocate our chesed? Right? David in our parak recognizes the value of family. He sends a Nichum Avelim delegation to the king for losing his father. David appreciates the kindness that was done to his brother, his fugitive brother, told said the Mefarshim. David understands the value of family. Avishai and Yoav appreciate the value of family, the trust that those two brothers can have. And yet they're fighting against nations which are supposed to be our brothers. And yet they have totally turned against us. You know, a couple of prakim ago, we talked about all the different battles on the other side of the Jordan River and how the Navi kind of brought back the echoes of the battle of the four kings, the five kings, in a number of different ways. And the point then was to show the emphasis on the spoils. That David is winning so many battles, but the Navi was telling, you know, look at the spoils. Don't look at the conquest and look at the fact that David is dedicating the spoils to the Beit HaMikdash. We have this once again over here. Once again, we have an affiliation, right, a coalition of kings, right? The Navi said, scroll up for one second. Kol Hamalachim, right? All of these kings who are vassals of Hadadezer. I don't think we've seen a coalition of kings like this who are vassals to another king all fighting together since the battle of the four kings and the five kings. Except this time, right? It's Ammon, who is hiring four different kings. Ammon is hiring Aram Tzova, Aram Rehov. He's hiring Macha, he's hiring Tov. Ammon, right, who we saved in the battle of four kings and five kings, instead is hiring four kings to go fight against Bnei Yisrael, right? Where did Avram win his battle? Avram took his battle to Chobah, to Damasek. Avram took his battle into smack in the middle of Syria. Now the same thing is happening. Right, the chesed that Avraham paid to Lot, this is the nail in the coffin. David tries one more time. But if last week the reconciliation was successful, David and Shaul could reconcile. Mephibosheth could be brought back into Yerushalayim. This time, we see why on full display, it's all over. Right, it's all over. The nations which are supposed to be our brothers are acting like anything but, and instead, it is Bnei Yisrael as the individual Jews. It is David, and it is Yoav, and it is Avishai, who are so sensitive to the value and the power and the unity of brotherhood and family, right? Leading to all the success that they have. And then Mida keneged mida. It's really a perfectly fitting punishment for Ammon and Aram, which is they betrayed us. They brought together a coalition of kings to betray and to attack Bnei Yisrael. Where are they left at the end of the day? They're left at the end of the day, betrayed, isolated. According to the Malbim, Ammon betrays Aram. They don't go out to fight. The Navi tells us black on white that Aram betrays Ammon. They won't go out to fight anymore. The whole coalition that Aram has betrays Aram, and they go and attempt to make peace with Bnei Yisrael, right? Those who, you know, betray us, betray the bonds of brotherhood with us, to gang up on us, the ultimate Mida Keneged Mida is that their bonds with each other are broken, and they're left isolated while David and Yoav are left in charge, right? I think it's a really perfect thing. One last point to close the parak, which is the Navi also built up to David's activity over here. There were a lot of delegations, right? Everyone was sending people. David was sending a delegation to Ammon, and then David sends Yoav and Avishai to battle, and then this guy, Hadarezer, sends his general Shobach. Everyone was sending different people to battle. What was the culmination of? What was the climax of the parak? When finally the king himself, rather than sending a delegation, sending clothing to the delegation, sending generals, Yoav is sending Avishai, Hadarezer is sending his general. Well, the turning point, the final turning point was when David himself gathered all of Bnei Yisrael, and he at their head goes to battle. Right, that was the moment where everything was finished off. As amazing as Yoav and Avishai are, the successful climax is when David takes the battle himself. If we have that in mind, that sets up a very compelling diuk that the Malbim makes on the very next pasuk. Because the very next pasuk, as we now shift into the world of David and Bathsheba. Right after all of this amazing chesed and bitachon and unity and family values and the king being together with his men, what happens in the next pasuk? It's 1 year later. It's the time for kings to go to battle. The rainy season is past. It's time for the next campaign. So David sends Yoav and the army to take care of unfinished business and attack Ammon. Last year we attacked Aram. Now we'll attack Ammon. Gotta take revenge on them. David Yoshev Yerushalayim. But David himself stays in Yerushalayim. The Malbim jumps all over that pasuk. We'll talk about this more in detail next week. And he says that that is the sin which leads to everything else. When David now stops being the active leader of the people, right? He stays in Yerushalayim. Then what's going to happen? We're going to have David in the palace, taking a nap. David's tired. David's resting. The rest of the vacation may be deserved for a regular person. When you're the king and you think it's time to lighten up, all of a sudden we're going to have David on the rooftop seeing Vayar, Isha, Rochatzes, Malagag, seeing a woman bathing on the top of the roof, and it's all going to go downhill from there. And the truth is that so many of the values that are on full display in our parak, the unity, right, the honesty, the trust between the members of the army, the trust between family members, the dedication of the king to his army, all of the chesed that David had at the beginning, it's all going to fall apart kind of shockingly quickly. We'll have to figure out how it could be that we can have such a radical transformation, but we should really keep in mind that everything that's fantastic in Parak Yud is setting up the polar opposite in Parak Yud Aleph, and we should flag that and think about how that could be. Okay. So we'll stop here, and everyone hopefully stay indoors as much as possible.